May I please report, Mr. Michael Young will begin arguing for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please report, statutory task under section 15003 has four elements, and I propose to focus my oral argument this morning on the essential need element.
Can I ask you a question?
You may.
There's an and between the third and fourth element.
Yes, sir.
Do I take that to mean, or do you agree or disagree, that the legislature intended that if you're going to take advantage of that, you have to prove all four elements?
That's correct, Your Honor. Each element has a semicolon after it, and then the and is...
And so, in this case, is there no dispute that somebody's either proved or hadn't proved the other three, and that's why we can zero in on essential need?
No, Your Honor. All four elements are disputed. The question, I guess, is which aspects of the Court of Appeals decision are most troublesome? And that was my choice of focusing on the essential need element.
Well, just for setting up the argument, you could find that we agree with one side or the other, but there's another element missing or goes the other way, that's determinative of that issue, isn't it? But nobody argues anything but essential need in this case.
Well, if you agree with me on essential need, that could dispose of the case. If
I understand.
You disagree with me on essential need, then the other three elements would need to be reached.
But we don't know what anybody says about those.
Well, they've been covered in the briefs, and I'd be happy to discuss them if you like.
No, I just was interested. Go ahead, please.
I apologize. I do also want to discuss the question of the proper proof standards of all four elements under the statute. With respect to those proof standards, the Court of Appeals failed to recognize that a 15003 decision is in reality three sequential decisions. If you look at the structure and language of the statute, it calls upon the court first to determine if the plaintiff can independently maintain a proper venue. That is a venue decision. If the answer to that is no, the court is next called upon to determine if the plaintiff can meet the four joinder tests of Section 15003. That is a joinder decision.
But it's subsumed within the venue statute, and the purpose of the venue statute and the level of proof that's required is that it be an expedited proceeding. And if we go with the joinder standard, then we're going to have evidence in a mini trial, which is what the venue provisions are designed to avoid.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that is an argument that was made to the legislature by the opponents of this statute, and the legislature determined to pass the statute. I don't think the fact that heretofore venue decisions, which have turned on rather objective elements, who lives where the operative events occurred, where a corporation's principal office is, the fact that those decisions have been made according to a prima facie standard does not dictate that the rather different standards of 15003, particularly the last three standards, which are very subjective, should be governed by the same kind of proof standard.
Well, because of that, you think then that there should be a mini trial on the joinder?
Yes, and Professor Hazel in his seminar paper thinks that there would have to be that. It would vary from case to case. It may be that in some cases, most of the elements are undisputed, and the focus would be on only one element.
But how do you, I'm sorry, but not to interrupt, but on that issue, 15003 says that this determination of joinder is going to be on an independent determination from the record, which tracks language right out of our Ruiz case. And the argument is, in Ruiz, we said that it's not a preponderance of the evidence, it's just some evidence.
Well, you have to, and we make this point in our reply brief, you have to separate the appellate standard of review from the trial court's standard for decision. This court's and the Court of Appeals standard of appellate review is an independent review, but that is separate and apart from the question of what standard does the trial court use in making that decision that's going to be reviewed. And Ruiz dealt with a situation where it was very clear what the trial court standard is. The rule specified it, the statute specified it. It was a prima facie standard. This case, on the other hand, calls upon this court to determine what the joinder standard of proof in the trial court is, although we know that then on appeal, the review is going to be an independent review and neither abuse of discretion nor substantial evidence. So that's the distinction between this case and Ramirez. Whether the procedure for determination of these joinder issues should be, for example, like the Rule 128 procedure, where affidavits submitted in advance are admissible, or like the motion for new trial standard, where an affidavit, if uncontroverted, is taken as true, but if controverted, triggers a right to an evidentiary hearing. That is a matter for this court to determine in the exercise of how it thinks best for judicial administration purposes. But the point at the moment is that it makes no sense to try and determine subjective things like essential need, fairness and convenience of the venue, absence of unfair prejudice, from a one-sided affidavit on a prima facie standard. That is an unworkable standard because in virtually no case will the plaintiff be unable to come up with any evidence whatsoever of essential need or fairness of the venue or lack of unfair prejudice. To apply a prima facie standard is to effectively mean that the statute is never applied.
Do I understand then from your argument that if the court determines that the venue standard of review applies in this circumstance, that Surgitech then would lose?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. He would just then provide the perspective from which the court evaluates each of the four elements. We might lose on some elements, but we maintain that there is no evidence in this record, prima facie or otherwise, of an essential need to maintain venue in Bexar County or on some of the other elements. So we believe that even a prima facie standard would permit us to affirm the trial court's decision.
Well, what's left if you can't do a sufficiency or an abuse of, well, substantial evidence or an abuse of discretion review by an appellate court?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, because 15003 differs from the 1506 1B appellate review standard in that it specifically negates substantial evidence review.
And
in Ruiz, the court essentially said the standard is a no evidence standard, which means some evidence is sufficient. And yet this statute says you can't say, well, there's substantial evidence, so that's sufficient.
Well, but substantial evidence in some ways says that when you look at the whole record, even if you disagree with whoever made that decision, if there's some evidence to support it, then you can't overturn it. And that's exactly what we said in Ruiz. If there's probative evidence to support the trial court's determination, even if the preponderance is to the contrary, we defer to the trial court.
Well, and that is not the same as, but it's akin to a substantial evidence review. It's more deferential than a substantial evidence review.
Well, it sounds like Walker versus Packard.
And yet this statute specifically says you don't use substantial evidence.
I know that.
We're writing on a blank page, and I guess the best that I can offer for the court is that the court probably should afford deference to a trial court's findings on very specific facts.
Well, then you have to have findings of fact and conclusions of law.
You would in order to
do we have those in this case?
We do not have those in this case.
And then how can we do that in this case?
Well, there are no discrete contested issues of fact, the light was red, no, the light was green, I, the trial court, find as follows. This is a question of a record which contains no internal disputes, but then from which inferences must be drawn. And I would say that under the 15003 standard, the Court of Appeals and this court must indulge a more free review of those inferences than you would ordinarily do where you defer to the trial court's inferences from the facts of the crimes.
Then it really boils down to saying, we're going to look at this record and decide whether the trial court properly applied the four elements of 15003 to this factual circumstance.
That is right, and the only thing I would add to that is you probably should defer to the trial court's decision on which witness was telling the truth and which one was lying, or a discrete factual dispute such as that. But in terms of the conclusions to be drawn from the factual record, I think this court...
Then his final step to say on this factor number three, if we take your side, when we apply the law to this record, we're going to find no fact that would lead legally to find an essential need to have that plaintiff's claims tried in that county.
Now, that again would be a no evidence review applied against the trial court's finding. I think what this court has to say is, do the facts shown in this record establish to our satisfaction, in light of the legal standards for essential need, that there was an essential need here? That's a rather unique standard of appellate review, I acknowledge. It's one prescribed
by the... Well, but essential need's not defined.
That is correct, Your Honor.
It's in the eye of the beholder, it's subjective.
It is in the eye of the beholder and subjective, but that does not mean that there are not legal guidelines that can be established to guide the decision of what that means. And the Adams Court, and at least at the Court of Appeals level, the respondents, and Justice Duncan in her dissent, drew on the Black's Law Dictionary definition. There's nothing magic about that definition. We've cited some dictionary definitions that are very similar. It is a very exacting standard. It is essential means of the essence of a thing. As Black says, that which is required for its continued existence. So it's a very high standard.
Is that...
See, would you go back and articulate the first step part on what the way the trial court is actually trying these issues?
It first has to determine whether the plaintiffs can independently establish proper venue. That's a venue decision. It's done prima facie on affidavits. It then has to determine, if not, whether these four tests are satisfied.
So it's a two-part trial. Look at the venue and say the trial court says, I don't think they can hold venue here in Stark County. And they say, well, we've got to do it because of 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you have...
That's correct, and we even think there's a small third part after that. If the court determines that the case has, excuse me, has to be transferred, then it's got to pick a transferee county and transfer. But yes, essentially, you're right.
Can separate tort, meaning not injuries that occur to multiple people as a result of one occurrence, but in fact perhaps a similar type of occurrence that occurs at different times, different places, to different plaintiffs, can that ever meet the same transaction or occurrence test of the joinder rule?
Yes, if the occurrences are so logically connected that it is fair to say that it is not isolated transactions or occurrences, but a series. And if that sounds vague, it is.
That's what I was going to say. So can you give us a practical example of when that would be met?
Yes. A General Motors vehicle has a particular defect in its brakes, and on two successive days, or two successive months, the brakes fail on a vehicle of this type in a similar manner, causing a similar injury. That might well be a series of occurrences. In this case, the statute requires not only an essential need, but an essential need to try the plaintiff's...
You didn't quite finish.
I'm sorry.
What I want to get you to tell me what you think happens in the second part when you're looking at the four elements. Who does what and who has the burden?
Well, clearly the plaintiff has the burden. The statute says so. The burden is to establish the four elements. We say that establish, to the extent it means establish a proposition of law, means prove by argument. That to the extent it applies to a question of fact, it means prove by evidence. But whatever that burden is, the burden is on the plaintiff. Now,
but it's more than just affidavits.
It should be more than just affidavits, because those elements are not susceptible to proof by affidavit. There's too much risk that a wrong decision will be reached if the trial court relies on one side's affidavit. Where somebody lives.
I take it from your brief that your position on this is because it's not just a venue statute, it's also a joinder statute.
That is correct. The statute says plaintiffs who cannot independently maintain venue may not join or maintain venue.
What would it take to meet the essential need requirement? I know you claim it was not met here, so we're talking negative, but what would it take to meet it?
It would take quite a bit. In the abstract, it would take something that really makes it impossible for the plaintiff to sue otherwise. I can give you some examples. Necessary parties would be the best example. By law, you can't sue without the presence of a necessary party. A spousal or parental consortium claim or some other claim that depends on injury to another. Wrongful death beneficiaries who live in different localities. By law, all proper wrongful death beneficiaries must join together in bringing the suit. I can conceive of a case
if
where...
If both are the categories, don't we already have terminology in Texas law that would pick that up? If essential just means parties that are
indispensable.
Necessary, indispensable, or...
Well, but the first sentence of 15003 says multiple plaintiffs must independently establish proper venue. If you don't then have an exception for the necessary parties, the consortium claims, etc., then those people are going to be out in the cold. If my wife is killed in an automobile accident and I live someplace and my children sue someplace else, if you don't have that exception, there may be no place that we can join together. And so that exception is there to allow for that circumstance and to create a place where we can join together. Finally, Justice Hankinson, I can conceive of a case, for example, where a plaintiff is in extremis and the proof shows that in all the other alternative venues, the dockets are so clogged that she's going to be deprived of her day in court. A situation like that, but something far more than we have on this record.
Any other questions?
Time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Sheriff, I'll present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. Your Honors, it's difficult for me to know exactly where to begin because I know that this statute presents this court with a question of first impression, and counsel for appellant has spent the entire period of time arguing about the procedural issues, what the appellate standard of review is, and what the quantum of proof should be at the trial court level. Those are critical issues, but not to the exclusion of giving guidance, if that's what this court intends to do, on the rest of the statute. But I think maybe the best place for me to begin is by way of status, because as the court well knows, this is certainly a case that is presenting an interlocutory appeal, and that means that the case below is not static. It's important for the court to know what the context is in which you're writing, and as well the context of the other cases that are existing at the appellate court level on this same issue. I'll start first with this particular case. It is my understanding, and that's important for the court to know, it is simply my understanding that there is an effort underway to reach a meeting of the minds to settle all of the cases that are involved in this particular case. We will do everything that we can to keep the court apprised, but this is an ongoing, again, process during the course of this interlocutory appeal. But it is my understanding that process, though there's not a writing there's a settlement in writing, there is a meeting of the minds that may be formalized shortly. So we'll advise the court of that. Further,
is there a period of time for which we ought not to work very hard on this before?
Your Honor, I posed that very question so that I might give the court further guidance. I asked if there was a timetable that was aspirational, at least for the parties at the trial level, to work this out, and I was told no. There is, in the course of these negotiations, there's not a time frame that is an open
date. Is it a fair question to ask that the settlement details may depend on what the court does here, which is why there's no time specified?
It's absolutely a fair question, Your Honor. It's my understanding.
Well, then I guess the disturbing question then is, are we in the process of about to render an advisory opinion if your controversy goes away?
That's my purpose in raising the issue. If we discover that...
Can I move to adjourn court and we'll just all go home?
That would certainly...
That's a disturbing aspect to when you say that, and even realizing that the issues are ones of first impression and need to be decided, but that this case may not be the one that's going to be where it's decided because it settles.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's my purpose in raising it at the very outset. Mm-hmm. Again, it's an ongoing process, and I think it's only reached the point today where I can even say that it's close.
Thank you for letting us know. Now go ahead with your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, there's another piece of advice in terms of status that I have to give the court. There is another, I won't say a companion case. The cases are completely different in terms of their factual development and the court of locale. But there is another Section 15.003 case that is pending in this court. It's the Adams versus Surgitech opinion. It is also my understanding, we are, our trial counsel in this case is also trial counsel in that case. My understanding that all of those cases have been non-suited, that the cases have been dismissed at the trial level, those cases are no longer pending. Again, that's just my understanding by way of status. It is also my understanding, no, this is not my understanding, this is a fact, that there's been development within the last 15 to 16 days in the area of what cases the court might wish to consider in the area of 15.003. I just learned in preparation for this argument there is a new opinion that has been issued by the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth on Section 15.003 just on December the 31st of 1998. It is the citation 1998 Westlaw 906999. Briefly, that case is Bristol-Myers versus Golson. My understanding is Mr. Young is actually involved in that case. It's only just come to my attention. My understanding of the facts of that case are that it is also a breast implant case.
But we're going to decide this case unless you settle, so we need to hear your argument. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, the reason that I bring this up is because it's another opinion in which the court has discussed essential need, which is apparently the most important issue for the appellants in this particular case, whether or not the Court of Appeals decision that essential need is settled or satisfied by the pooling of resources to meet the common experts in this particular case. And it was a similar determination by the Court of Appeals in the Goldston case that there were common treating physicians, things of that sort, that satisfied the essential need. So it was a similar sort of pooling of resources that the Court of Appeals determined in Goldston satisfied essential need in affirming the trial court decision.
But that's a test that seems like a low threshold. It means that if it's going to cost more money to try it elsewhere, then by golly, it's essential that we not spend that extra money, we just try it here. And that's going to be true in every joint case. So why would that test not pretty much eviscerate the rule?
I don't think it would eviscerate the rule, Your Honor, because essential need is not the only factor to be considered. That's the first reason that it would not eviscerate the rule. The reason that it serves as a parameter of any kind is because there still needs to be some evidence that there is a benefit to be derived. For example, in this particular case, because we had submitted evidence that the experts that the defendants were going to call were common, we had established that there was a need to pool resources against those common experts.
But the statute doesn't say essential need to have the claims tried together. It says tried in the county in which the suit is pending.
True.
Now, how does that help? To me, that doesn't address the need to have the claims tried together. Also, it seems that the first paragraph, joinder or intervention, that deals with common issues, common witnesses, common experts, common counsel. Doesn't it seem logical to you that essential need means something different than those types of joinder considerations?
Yes, Your Honor, it must mean something different, or it would be surplusage. I think that I would have
so
to...
So what different besides common witnesses, common counsel, common experts does it mean?
I think it means, similar to what the Able Court of Appeals has said, that you have to have a need to do that. Not that there's a judicial economy, which is the joinder, it seems to me the joinder test, that the judicial economy derives from it, but that the plaintiffs themselves have an essential need. If they are unable to prosecute their claims without deriving that common benefit from the pooling of resources, then they don't have an open forum, and that's what essential
needs.
Under
that argument, you're focusing on the plaintiffs who are already in that county as opposed to the plaintiffs we should be focusing on, the ones who want to join in the suit.
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm focusing on all of the plaintiffs, which is what the trial court was obligated to do under this analysis.
Well, but the plaintiffs who are already in the county are not part of the appeal, correct?
That's correct.
So we are then focusing on the others who are trying to come in and join.
At this level, there's no question about that, Your Honor. But the argument, what the argument asks is, was there an essential need for these plaintiffs to get a common benefit from one another?
But not just a common benefit from one another, if that's the test, but in this instance, particularly Bexar County.
Right.
It's an essential need to be in Bexar County, not just an essential need to be together. And based on the affidavit proof, assuming that that was sufficient procedurally that was presented in this case, what made the essential need exist, as you define it, only in Bexar County?
That's a very difficult question, Your Honor.
Isn't that part of the requirement?
It certainly appears on the face of the statute to be part of the requirement.
So that's what was the essential need to be in Bexar County in this case?
As the Court of Appeals found, the essential need was the pooling of resources against the common experts. That's what the Court of Appeals found. The Court of Appeals was completely concerned by what Your Honor is raising, and that is that it appeared that the statute didn't say that there was an essential need to join. It said there was an essential need to join in Bexar County. My
Can't best you pool them in Dallas?
Could you pool them? Yes.
Can't you?
Yes.
Most
I mean, 104 of the planes went to Dallas.
That's
where
true.
They all live.
That's true.
How
I'm sorry, that last statement. Forgive me.
How does the test that you propose, how would that lead to a different result in the Polaris case, which just on legislative history, you must assume if this statute means anything, Polaris comes out different. Were there any other cases in the nation?
It does, Your Honor. Polaris comes out differently under this statute for so very many reasons. And it's important for me to point out that not only is 15.003 part of the response to the Polaris decision, but there's a host of other statutes that were enacted in response to the Polaris decision. That's what Justice Rickoff's concurring opinion in this case is all about. You recall Justice Rickoff is the one that wrote the concurring opinion in the Polaris decision, pointing out how egregious the violations were in the Polaris decision and calling for someone to do something. And the legislature didn't just respond with 15.003, but 15.003 would have eliminated that case, take the element of unfair prejudice. Pat Maloney in the Polaris case had himself admitted that his purpose in selecting that particular forum was unfair prejudice. Well, we certainly don't have that in this case because there cannot be an allegation that Bexar County, with a rotating docket, presents some sort of an unfair forum for these particular defendants. It's not Eagle Pass, Texas, and there's certainly no evidence. They submitted no evidence to the trial court. There's certainly no evidence before this court that Bexar County would have provided the same sort of forum. But there's more. Section 15.003 is not the only thing that defendants get to rely on to eliminate a Polaris problem. There is Section 71.051, the Forum Nonconvenience Statute, and that brings me back to Your Honor's point. The reason that the plaintiffs, the bulk of the plaintiffs, were transferred to Dallas County in this case is not because they were residents of Dallas County. It's because that was the principal place of business of the defendant. What that means is that the defendant is still going to be able to make the argument that somehow the plaintiffs have been forum shopped in this case from out of state, because the majority of those particular plaintiffs are out of state plaintiffs. They are going to have their day in court, if you will, as to whether or not this was Polaris egregious conduct, because they're going to get to ask the trial court to send Illinois plaintiffs back to Illinois.
But then we're under an entirely different part of the law. The point is that the independent venue can be established in Dallas County, right? So you're not even getting into all of the tests of 15.03. But going back to what we have in this case, how do we deal with this record in terms of affirming what the Court of Appeals did by saying there's an essential need in Bexar County? How is that requirement met? Do you agree that it is a requirement?
I agree that it appears to be a requirement, but I also agree that the ABLE court below struggled with that analysis and said if what we're going to do is construe the statute to mean that if a plaintiff has got any plaintiff is going to have to do what the appellants in this case say, if they're going to have to be able to demonstrate that if they can't file their cause of action in Bexar County, they can't file it anyplace else in Texas, then the statute really means nothing. The other elements are absolutely irrelevant. All in the world you need to do is ask the question, is there another county of proper venue, and you're finished. Because under Section 15.003, you never reach any of the four factors unless you've determined that plaintiff cannot independently establish proper venue. So the minute the defendants submit their affidavit of the principal place of business, we're through. We're drinking coffee on whether or not a plaintiff can get that benefit that the legislature clearly intended there still be available to them. That can't be what the legislature meant, and that's what the court below determined.
So in other words, we just don't pay attention to that proper county language?
No, Your Honor, I don't think you simply ignore it. I'm not proposing that you pretend that the legislature didn't say those words, But I think what you have to do is say there's an essential need to join in Bayer County in this case, for example.
And which is what?
To pool resources in this case. I don't think you have to be able to say that they could not pool resources someplace else. There's got to be something, some benefit to a plaintiff under the essential need element to pool resources in order to make it worthwhile to even bring.
Do I understand by your comment that you would agree that if these 103 plaintiffs had filed this suit in Dallas County, that you could pool your resources and the experts there just as easy as you could in Bayer County?
I'd have to concede that, Your Honor.
And every one of those 103 plaintiffs could maintain their lawsuit and the courts would be open to them in Dallas County.
I would have to concede that, Your Honor. I would have to concede.
But doesn't then your viewpoint right out of the third factor in the county which the suit is pending?
No, Your Honor.
How do you avoid that language? What is the rationale that you advance to avoid that language?
Let me state it this way. I think in order to do what Your Honor is suggesting and what the appellants are suggesting, you would have to read that provision, Section 3, to say there is an essential need to maintain your lawsuit in the venue of suit as opposed to any other venue in Texas. And that's not what it says. It doesn't require a plaintiff to establish, by whatever quantum of proof this court determines applies today, it does not require a plaintiff to establish that this is the only place to the exclusion of every other place.
No, no. What it does require you to show that whatever this need is, it has to be accomplished in the county where you file suit.
Right.
And so what is the need that makes Bayer County so special?
Bayer County is special because there's another lawsuit pending there.
Yeah, Ms. McCauley, from
who's
reading the...
The two plaintiffs that they're not here?
Exactly.
Did you put on evidence at trial or in the trial court that these two plaintiffs could not pursue their breast implant claims if these 104 cases were severed from their two? Did you all put on that evidence?
Yes.
And so you're willing to state that if this joinder were carried on... severance were carried forward and the transfer is carried forward, that your two plans are going to dismiss their claims in Bayer County?
I don't think we can say that we're going to dismiss the claims because I think that would involve an uncomfortable situation for a plaintiff's lawyer saying, I have taken on your lawsuit, I have agreed to provide you.
Well, you can't have it both ways. It seems to me you can't represent to the trial court that it's impossible for us to go forward. We cannot on our own hook proceed. At the same time say, but we won't dismiss if it's severed.
I understand the concern, Your Honor, but I think from a practical standpoint, we have to be able to have it both ways. Otherwise, what we're saying is that once the case becomes economically disadvantageous, the plaintiff who has made a decision to move forward and who is deprived of the economic advantage really does lose her right to the courthouse based upon a judgment that her trial lawyer has made. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that what we're saying is that the plaintiff's lawyer has to put on evidence that he is going to simply take the hit with his client and dismiss her lawsuit, leaving her with no remedy if he can't join.
He can file it in Dallas, can he, where the defendant resides?
Not with those two particular plaintiffs.
Why can't she sue them where the defendants
reside? Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's absolutely right. Those two, because venue would be proper against the defendant.
But isn't that what the legislature intended when the venue is supposed to be under these statutes where the defendant resides? Isn't that what they intended in the end?
I sure hope not, Your Honor, because if that's what it means, then all the defendant has to do to shift the status of Texas law and make it no longer can we have plaintiffs forum shopping. We're going to make it defendants that are forum shopping. That's all they need to do in order to prevent plaintiffs from joining their
lawsuit. Isn't the forum shopping really going on in Bayer County, not Dallas County?
No, Your Honor.
Why were the 104 plaintiffs who didn't live in Bayer County joined there in the first place?
Or
why weren't they joined in Dallas?
They weren't joined in Dallas because there were two lead plaintiffs that Mr.
But 104 out of 106 lived in Dallas.
That's correct.
So who's doing the forum shopping there?
Your Honor, the plaintiff is doing the forum shopping that the statute permits. And that's my concern, is that every time there's a joinder of plaintiffs who cannot independently establish venue, we call that forum shopping.
But you're saying the courts of the state are no longer open. That's just not true. These two plaintiffs can file their lawsuit in Dallas.
Only if they're prepared to wait in line behind every other lawsuit, such as every other breast implant lawsuit, that's going to have to go to Dallas.
Why can't they join with the 104 that were transferred up there?
They can, but what this court would be holding is that in order for mass plaintiffs to join under 15003, they're going to have to do it in Dallas, because that's where every major manufacturer has got its principal place of business. So the only way that a plaintiff is going to be able to get the economic advantage of joinder is for that plaintiff to go to Dallas, where they're going to have to wait in line behind every other mass court plaintiff.
What was your evidence on economics? Why can't they proceed in Bexar County, these two plaintiffs?
It was the affidavit of Mr. Gallagher. Now, I don't want to suggest to the court that Mr. Gallagher's affidavit says anything about the two plaintiffs not being able to go to Dallas. That was
wrong. What was the economic evidence? Why can't your two plaintiffs in Bexar County afford to proceed in Bexar County?
Because the status, and of course most of this was argued to the trial court as well, because the status of cases such as breast implants, in Mr. Gallagher's experience, have shown him that only when plaintiffs can pool their resources to meet the significant experts around the country that the defendants have got, only then are they able to have an economic advantage in their case.
Explain that. I want the specifics. Mr. Gallagher's counsel in both cases, the same witnesses would appear in both cases. What economic differences are there trying these two in Bexar County and the rest of them in Dallas County? Why is that economically impossible for your two plaintiffs in Bexar County?
Your Honor, if I may answer the question in two parts, because when we argued this at the trial court level, my answer would have had to have been different. It was prior to your N. Ray Ethel and N. Ray Bristol Myers decision. So my answer at the trial court level was that these cases would be tried at least two, three, maybe five at a time. And the expert would come into town and testify one time for five plaintiffs. In other words, it was an economic advantage that was associated with trial of these cases as a cluster. After your N. Ray Bristol Myers cases, I think that's difficult for me to stand before you and say that we know to a paralyzed certainty we would get that economic advantage at the trial court level. And so my fallback position is this. The economic advantage that we want is the same economic advantage that the defendants asked for when they asked the MDL court to consolidate all breast implant cases that were filed in the federal court so that they wouldn't have to present their experts more than one time. They wouldn't have to do their trial preparation more than one time. Courts wouldn't have to listen to the pretrial motions more than one time.
In that regard, let me ask you how our Rule 11, not particularly in this case, because Dallas and San Antonio are a long way off, but how just overall in this area, how does that impact on this? Because a lot of the pretrial is going to be done with common experts across county lines. And that's where I suppose most of the expense is. It's not flying somebody in for the occasional one of these cases, it's actually just a trial.
I appreciate the question, Your Honor, because it allows me to state to you my greatest concern about the interpretation of this statute in context with all of the other rules that this court has issued and statutes that the legislature has written. Rule 11 that you're specifically asking about, as I view it, is an opportunity for a defendant faced with two cases that arise out of material common questions of law and fact to petition the regional judge to consolidate those cases for pretrial. My view of it is that is a defendant's Rule 40. Because there's no question that Rule 11 is simply designed as a pretrial consolidation of cases for that sort of judicial economy as well as party economic advantages.
We can argue about, technically there is no consolidation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But in terms of the economic impossibility of just two plaintiffs going forward, the chances are, in any kind, that there will be other plaintiffs in that county or surrounding counties identical or nearly identical experts, and an overlap if not identical lawyers on both sides.
That's exactly right. That's why my cleanest answer to your question is that I think Rule 40 and 15.003 are designed to accomplish exactly the same purposes as Rule 11 with one material difference. If Rule 11 is going to be the vehicle by which these economies are achieved, the plaintiffs lose that one fundamental right they've been trying to hold on to from the very beginning, which is they have the initial right to select the forum.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Clyde, on exactly that. They have the right because that's the way the venue statute is written, and we've interpreted it that way. Couldn't the legislature come in and say, for mass tort litigation, you must sue in the county where the defendant is located?
No question about it.
They could say that. Now, they haven't said that in so many words in this statute, but it seems to me in the reading the briefs of the parties, this statute is only susceptible of extremes. It's either interpreted the way you would like to interpret it, which in event, if you we have permissive joinder, once you've got permissive joinder, you can always prove the economies of scale. That's what mass tort litigation is all about. And therefore, wherever you find a plaintiff who can establish independent venue, that's where you can bring your lawsuit. Or you interpret it the way that Surgitec interprets it, which is essential need must mean something because it's in addition to joinder. And this essential need, if you just look at the law dictionary or the Webster's dictionary on it, it's got to be essentially indispensable parties, in which event that's something the plaintiff can't ever prove. And so your two plaintiffs from San Antonio, to get the benefit of economy scale, will have to go to Dallas, even though they could independently prove venue, will have to go to Dallas because for economy of scale, they've just got to be a part of the larger picture. If the legislature could do it directly, I mean, what really is the problem with the court saying, well, it's kind of convoluted, but essentially, essential needs got to mean something other than just permissive joinder, and so we give it to the legislature. If it's going to be mass tort, it's got to go to wherever the company that sued is, or I guess the plaintiffs just end up in their own counties with these lawsuits by themselves. Why can't, I mean, what's the biggest reason that the court just ought not to do that?
You shouldn't do it because the legislature purposefully did not adopt the position that the appellants are suggesting to you. The legislature could have done exactly what Your Honor is suggesting, and they thought about doing it. But
essential needs got to mean something more than permissive joint.
No question about it, Your Honor, and I have to take issue with the court's characterization of our positions. I know it does appear that, and it's probably from the opinions more than it is from the appellee's brief, there's no question that the appellant's position, I think, would result in no more joinder. You would be looking only under 1502. There would not be any joinder for venue purposes of plaintiffs. But we're not suggesting that essential need simply means nothing. What we're asking you to do is read the statute as a whole and consider that the legislature had a purpose when they decided that there would be some circumstances in which plaintiffs could join and get that economic benefit. And
but
so
that's what I'm having a problem. You keep saying economic benefit is really what joiner is all about, and it's got to be something more, but you have yet to tell us what that something more is.
The something more is that it is a plaintiff economic advantage under essential need. We're looking at the factors as a whole and saying, what limitation does each one of these factors provide? The joiner, for example, provides...
But economies of scale, all that goes into the joiner mix.
That's right.
What, separate and apart from that, is essential need?
Separate and apart, because joiner, the joiner element, which is element one, has to do with the economies of the court of scale. It has
no,
to
it has to do with parties, too. We've discussed that. It's not just the court. It's the parties as well. So what beyond that is essential need?
Your Honor, what beyond it is essential need is exactly what the court below said. I distinguish between the joinder provision and the essential need provision to say that not only is judicial economy something that we would like to have under prong one, we'd like to have it because we satisfy the test, but under three, it's we need it. We really need it in order to keep the courthouse doors open. Not open because there's absolutely no place else to go, but because these causes of action, in order to be viable unto themselves, need to have that benefit together. So it's not that the question is different, it's that the level of the answer needs to be different. It's not just a good idea. It's something you really do need, but not something you absolutely have to have as an indispensable party, otherwise that element can't be met. But then the court has to ask the question in context about what kind of proof you need to have in order to show this. And once we've brought this evidence, does the appellee have to do anything? Can they make us, in this 15.003 context, have a trial on venue where they have affirmative defenses in the way of inconvenience, unfair pressure?
I could see your arguments if the, well, it wouldn't have happened, but if you were trying to just add the two plaintiffs onto the 104 in Dallas County, for some reason the defendants were trying to cut them out of the herd because they thought, well, if we cut them out, they'll probably go away. But you're arguing exactly the reverse. There is a forum in Dallas. That's where the legislature said these things should go, essentially. And you're saying, no, we should drag the 104 from Dallas down to join the two, so make it more convenient for the two. I mean, I take it that's your, in sum, your argument.
No, Your Honor. My argument is that all potential forums should remain open to all plaintiffs who are properly joined, unless there's some showing of a forum nonconvenience. I'm saying that Mr. Gallagher...
But that's not what the statute says.
It does, unless this court construes essential need to mean if there is another county of proper venue, you may not even try to meet the 0.003 factors. And if that's the way the court construes the essential need element, then there won't be any joint.
Well, but given your interpretation, and if one of your arguments is, well, everybody's going to have to sue Bristol-Myers in Dallas County because the courthouse is going to be overloaded and this is our benefits in Bexar County, then why aren't we back to Polaris? Find one Starr County plaintiff, take the other 105 down there, because Starr County has an even smaller docket than Bexar County does. So why aren't we back to exactly what the legislature was trying to deal with? Your analysis, as I understand your answers to Judge Owen's question.
You're not, because of the other elements of Section 15.003. The legislature said, what is it that we're trying to avoid by this type of Polaris joiner? Well, one of the things you're trying to avoid is unfair prejudice. And so we're going to put the burden on the plaintiffs to establish that there's no unfair prejudice. And then we're going to apply the venue. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Then we're going to apply the traditional venue standards to see if the appellees conclusively destroy that evidence. They didn't even try in this case. They seem to be suggesting that the court has to hold a hearing on these matters, but they never brought a shred of evidence that they were prejudiced. They never brought a shred of evidence that the forum was inconvenient. All they said was, we don't have a problem with the joinder in this case. In fact, we, the defendants, benefit from the joinder. We just think they have to do it in Dallas County. That's really all this is about. There's not really any contest from the defendants, not in the way of evidence and not really in the way of argument. They are agreeing that there are economies of scale to the courts and to the parties by joining. They just say they get to choose it because if there's another forum, if there's another venue, that controls. And we're saying the statute, if they're right, the statute means nothing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, let me first address the question of settlement. We are, it is true, closer to settlement than the average litigant that stands at this podium. But there is no settlement to date. The discussions to date have involved a great many contingencies which have not been satisfied. And Justice Baker, that does not include a contingency on the outcome of this case. We're not gambling on the outcome of this case or anything of the sort. If a settlement is reached, we will immediately advise the court. This is our obligation.
Let me ask you a question. As I read your brief, you really are saying that essential need essentially is a direction of the legislature that mass torts, for there to be all plaintiffs in one case, has got to be in the county where the company has its principal place of business. And that's essentially your position. And
that is more or less correct. I can't really conceive of how a large group of mass tort plaintiffs could prove an essential need to be in a particular county. It would be open to them to try, but I can't conceive.
But it's it really is, you look at essential need and almost equates it to an indispensable party that would put them out into Bexar County.
Clearly, indispensability would be sufficient. I'm not sure it's necessary. I think there may be a few other exceptional circumstances that would qualify as essential need.
I agree that
it has to mean something and it has to be possible to meet that standard. I don't agree that it has to be easy to meet that standard. The legislature started out with a draft of 15.003 that said every plaintiff must establish proper venue independently, period. It then, in the legislative process, added an exception to that. But it is an exception to a general rule. And it puts up some very high hurdles. But if the plaintiff can meet those hurdles, it's entitled to proceed.
And if the, and the reason, the in the county issue that's there, if you're an indispensable party and that lawsuit's pending in Bexar County, that's an essential need to be in Bexar County because
yes.
that's what lawsuit is.
Yes.
Right? So really we come back to this notion of the I've got to be in that lawsuit.
Yes, maybe because I'm legally indispensable or maybe because of some other factual, practical reason that rises to a very high level. But I've got to be in that county. It must be county specific. I will send the court a recent Dolston decision. It involved an essential need finding based on county-specific evidence. It was not just an allegation that there needed to be a pooling of resources. It was county-specific.
I think we've already got the Dolston decision. So.
With respect to the economic evidence in this record, Justice Owen, Mr. Gallagher's affidavit is at page 130 of the clerk's record. And I believe you'll find it really does not address economies of scale at all. It speaks more to the common issue of law or fact issue. Finally, the argument that because two plaintiffs are venued in Bexar County, the others have a need, because they have a need to pool resources to join with them, would read out of the statute the words independently of every other plaintiff. The statute requires each joining plaintiff who cannot independently maintain proper venue to establish independently of any other plaintiff the four elements. And so Ms. Abel, for example, who is a respondent here in this court, must show independently of the two Bexar County plaintiffs an essential need to be in Bexar County. And that she can't do certainly on this record and we believe in general.
Thank you, gentlemen. That concludes the argument in the second call. Take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.